I'm Zach. I'm a musician, a former worship leader. I helped destroy Mars Hill Church. I'm not really sure what I believe anymore, and I'm okay with that.
I'm Dave. I'm a Bible theology nerd, an occasional preacher, a movie buff. I'm thinking of the time where I watched that movie, John Carpenter's Halloween, and I was like 10 years old. And I promise I heard like somebody walking down the hallway at my old house. Oh, and I'm an evangelical.
And this is Veterans of Culture Wars. Ah, that's a jump scare, Dave. Didn't see that coming, did you?
Veterans of Culture Wars is a podcast where we talk about evangelical Christianity. For all of you out there, we have a Patreon, VCW Pod, if you want to help us out, and please leave a rating and a review for our show. This episode, I say we talk about evangelical Christianity, and as you dear listeners know out there, we occasionally talk movies as well, and then sometimes we talk Christianity and movies, and this is one of those occasions. So we are very excited for our guest today. He is a senior producer at Think Christian with Reframe Ministries, where they have a website, a podcast, a video channel. He is also a part of one of the great movie podcasts, in my estimation, out there, Film Spotting, with his co-host Adam Kempinar. In the past, he has written the book Movies Are Prayers, and his new book that we're going to talk about today is Fear Not, A Christian Appreciation of Horror Movies. And I don't think this is ground that really has been ever covered that much out there. So welcome to the show, Josh Larson.
Thank you so much, Dave. And did you say Halloween at 10? Did I hear that right?
Yeah, it was 10 or 11 for sure.
Holy cow.
Yeah.
Dave was not raised in an evangelical household, Josh.
You know that
he was heathen until he was 14, and it shows.
That doesn't always protect you. You know, I saw Friday the 13th probably around that age while traveling on vacation with a friend's family, you know. You get out there in that big scary world, who knows what's going to happen to you? You might just see a movie like Friday the 13th or Halloween.
Oh yeah. My goodness. Those are, well, Halloween a lot better than Friday the 13th. Can't say I'm a huge Indeed. Fan of the Friday the 13th franchise, but, you know, to begin the show here, Josh, I think you were raised actually in a Christian home. Would you like to talk about just your faith journey as you were growing up, and maybe as a bonus, add in how horror movies kind of played a part with you growing up with Christianity?
Sure. Yeah. You know, I joke about, you know, the evangelical home protecting you, but I don't know that my parents would have called our home evangelical. I don't know. I need to ask my dad this. That was a term that I still don't entirely know what it means. And I'm not sure the Christian subculture I grew up within would have identified with it. You know, it's really connected to the Dutch Reform tradition. That was the school system I attended, Christian school system with that background, and the churches I attended when I was young. So this would be the Christian Reformed Church of North America. That's actually where Reframe Ministries is based. So I'm actually working for the same denomination now. So yeah, some of those folks would probably say they are evangelical. Some folks would say they aren't. But for what that meant for me growing up in particular was it looked different depending on the Christians I was hanging out with. You know, some of my classmates had homes that were incredibly strict in terms of pop culture engagement. Others had no rules whatsoever. In our house, my parents loved movies, listened to music, had their favorite TV shows. And so we weren't taught to fear such things, but they also had their rules around them. You know, we weren't allowed to watch whatever we wanted. Age limits were, you know, observed, those sorts of things. So yeah, I'm grateful, you know, to be honest, that I had that experience. I talked to a lot of people who grew up differently, and it took a while for them to think through what that meant, especially as pop culture became a more important part of their lives. And so that's a lot of the folks we hang out with at Think Christian are people like that. Some who've engaged with pop culture their whole life of faith, and some who are just wrapping their minds around it. And yeah, it's kind of exciting to do that. But that was my story. And then in terms of horror movies, I think you were asking, right?
Yes.
Yeah, those would have been, you know, off limits when I was a kid. That's why I ended up seeing Friday the 13th at the neighbors with the neighbor's family. And I think that was not, you know, any sort of negation of horror as a genre, but just an awareness of the content that is in most horror films. And it, you know, not in my parents' eyes being appropriate for kids, which I think in most cases is probably correct. I don't know if we had, you know, I was born in 74. So I think of the 80s as my formative pop culture years. I don't know if we had horror for younger ages then, you know, where even in books and those sorts of things, which seem to come along in later years. So it just wasn't really an option that I thought about much unless I came across it when I wasn't supposed to.
Yeah, I was born in 82. And my parents, they ran a worship leader supply store. They were very much like of the Jesus people generation and all that. And we weren't completely culturally siloed off. Like I went to Christian school, but like both my parents were music majors in college. They had a deep appreciation of music. My dad knew that man could only live on CCM alone. and so like he was getting into like Brazilian jazz and like all sorts of other things. And movie wise, we didn't stay current. I don't really remember going to the movie theater until my teens. But we went to the library like every week, and I grew up watching a ton of like old, like the weirder Disney 60s, 70s live action stuff, you know? but horror, like I remember him specifically just like being just totally dismissive of horror and, but really referring to slashers, which in the 80s was like probably the predominant form of horror that you'd get. And much of the horror explosion of the 80s, I think is due to the advent of the VCR, right? And the sort of things that could be put out with no intention of a wide release led to more niche things, more extreme things. I mean, if you could even call, I would think my first horror, like really horror adjacent, would be like Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, and or like The Shaggy Dog, which there's little bits of that in there. But then like I remember Arachnophobia.
Oh, yeah.
Which I've watched that in the last few years. I think it holds up super well. I, you know, it was like directed by Kathleen Kennedy's husband just before Jurassic Park, and the opening of Jurassic Park, the first 20 minutes mirror the opening of Arachnophobia. It is wild. I think Spielberg took from that, which is fine. But yeah, I mean, sort of softball, just overview sort of in writing this, obviously a lot of people just like horror, Christian, those can't go together. You know, whatever is good, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, think on these things that can't include slashers. So how did you decide to write this book and to specifically encourage Christians as they are personally capable of approaching horror and taking it seriously?
Yeah. So you're referencing Philippians 4 verse 8. And that is the verse that will get thrown out if someone's skeptical about the horror genre. And it's a stance, a skepticism I understand. I mean, I want to say that out front, because as we've kind of already touched on, it is a genre where exploitation tends to take place quite frequently, you know, exploitation of violence, of sexuality. So I get it. This can be some incredibly rough stuff, but it's not in my nature to throw everything out just because of that reality. And I'm interested in exploring, okay, like other movie genres, how might this speak to us, particularly as Christians? And if you're willing to kind of go on into that investigation, I think, you know, it's a very rich genre, especially when we want to talk about just the general idea of fear and what that means in the Bible, and why are we told so many times in scripture to fear not or do not be afraid? Why is that so common? Obviously, the word decides this is something that needs to be addressed. And I think that's what the best horror movies can address as well. Before you get to the comfort that the gospel ultimately provides, the reason it's saying, fear not, you have to recognize why we're afraid. What is it about the world that is broken that scares us? What is it about ourselves that scares us, whether it's our own capacity for sin or whether it's our deep anxieties? And so many horror movies concern themselves with these things. And that's kind of why I broke the book down into subgenres, is so I could really look in detail at all the different fears that are being explored through the horror genre. It's not just one thing. And these are fears we all share. You know, if you think about, again, our own capacity for sin, that is a fear we have, especially for the faithful Christian trying to model their life after Jesus. Even look at something like, you mentioned Jurassic Park, you know, the fear of nature run amok. You know, this is a broken world after the fall. And that reveals itself in a number of ways. It's not just bad behavior by humans, right? There's something broken in creation itself. Now in Jurassic Park, it's broken because of humans and the choices humans make. And that's a distinction I talk about in that chapter. But yeah, I think that it was my instinct, being a horror fan for many years, that this was a dismissed genre in terms of the richness that's there. And so the project was to explore it from a distinctly theological lens and say, if that's the case, if it has a richness overall, then there's a theological richness to be found in it too.
You're talking about how it speaks to the parts of ourselves and our capabilities to cause horrific things. In the book you write, horror begins at home. On some days we fear ourselves the most, or at least the things we know we're capable of. Even those who have never considered committing any sort of crime know that a few, if not all, of the deadly sins still lurk somewhere in our hearts. What if we were to let one off the leash? I'm reminded of the sort of nightmares that I would have growing up versus coming into adulthood with different responsibilities and things, you know, before getting married. You know, like I remember I would have nightmares that my dad would abandon the family and me as the oldest boy, like me having to sort of replace him or whatever. When I got married, the nightmares became about me abandoning my own family. I've been on a journey of learning not to fear myself quite so much these days or my body, but to listen to it and take care of it. And I think I have fewer nightmares these days. But I do appreciate horror more than I did like a decade or so ago. I'm wondering what your nightmares are like and what are the elements of horror that play to your fears about yourself?
Yeah, what are my nightmares like? Man, I didn't know we were going to go there. I feel like at middle age, at least for me, it is more like low-level stress, anxiety. That's just always kind of the troubling dreams rather than any specific incidents, you know, and probably that's because I've been, you know, blessed to live a fairly protected life. So there's no huge, considerable trauma that, you know, I imagine would be the stuff that you're processing in your dreams. So for me, it's, you know, it's more of that like existential sort of anxiety stuff that is peppered with the everyday concerns when you are married, father of two teenagers. Well, one teenager and one young adult now, you know, that has its specific concerns. Those are the kinds of things that tend to keep me up at night. Now, when I see a horror movie that really gets under my skin, I'll have a nightmare about that and maybe a particular image, as a matter
like
of fact.
A bird.
I think of the film. What's that?
I just love that you write that the thing that distresses you the most is birds.
Yes. But yes.
What's your deal with birds, Josh? Come on.
Yeah. I mean, you know, when Alfred Hitchcock makes a movie about them, that's when I get distressed about them. But even something like a movie like The Orphanage, you know, I read about this as well, directed by J.A. Bayona, a Spanish language film. Actually, there is I don't want to give too much away, but a figure in that film of a child who wears this sack over his head. And there are reasons for that. I've had nightmares about that since seeing that movie. So it gets very specific in that sense. But yeah, I can't say I point to a recurring nightmare about a single thing that has continued to haunt me. I think I'm grateful for that as well.
Yeah.
Speaking of nightmares, I know, you know, over the years of listening to Film Spotting, I know you're a huge fan of the first Nightmare on Elm Street movie. Freddy Krueger from the aforementioned 80s, the slasher kind of time when that was coming out. People talk about Dracula and Frankenstein, the Wolfman, and you cover all those in your book rather early on, all the classic Universal movies that came out in the 1930s, 1940s. But to me, like, I think one of the most terrifying fictional characters is Freddy Krueger. I mean, you know, a monster, this guy who's committed horrible crimes, who's now a spirit and can kill you in your sleep, you know, while human beings are totally vulnerable, right? Like, we can't fight back, we're asleep, we can't do anything. And just that primal terror that the character brings up when we think about him, it's just an incredible concept brought to life by Robert England. I mean, there's just something like the early human sleeping in a cave and the saber-toothed tiger lurking around outside. And do you remember the first time you saw that particular movie that you love so much and kind of what it's meant to you over the years? Or maybe it's weird to say what it meant to you, how it's freaked you out over the years, maybe.
Yeah, right. I was, as you were, you know, describing it, I was trying to remember when I first saw it. And it would have been when I was younger. So when that came out, you know, I was 10, this sort of formative age we were circling around, but I would not have seen it immediately then. I think it might have been, to your point, Zach, one of these VHS experiences a couple years later, perhaps. And it does tap into that primal fear that is the fear of being vulnerable when we're asleep. It's just something I've always, you know, don't have necessarily nightmares about, but it's just always one of those unsettling things that I don't like to think about. Is I think I'm, you know, I'm a bit of a control freak. So it's also the element of you lose all control when you go to sleep, right? That's part of the vulnerability. So I think that has always unsettled me. But man, Dave, you're so right about Freddy Krueger. And there's two levels to that character. Is it's the way he works, as we were just talking about, when you're asleep and vulnerable, but also those earlier crimes, you know, that we learn about of him being a child killer. It's interesting, Zach, when you were talking about, you know, this nightmare, recurring nightmare you've had of abandonment of some kind. And when you were younger, it was about having to take care of, you know, your siblings. And I remember distinctly, I have two younger sisters, that one thing I would constantly be worried about as a kid was that someone might try to kidnap one of them. And I think that was a product of in the 80s. I think that's when like the whole milk carton fad was, you know, where they would have missing kids on milk cartons. So here you're sitting down for breakfast as a kid, and this is the first thing you're greeted with in the day is, you know, a kid who's been kidnapped. And I also remember a series of like TV movies on that subject. And I didn't even watch these, but it would just be seeing the commercials for them, right? It was, there seemed to be this child kidnapping. I don't know if it was a media sensationalized thing, if there were a few high profile cases in the 80s, but anyways, that was in the air. And then Nightmare on Elm Street comes around and it's tapping into that as well. So I think that is where the root, it's not an attraction, but fascination with that movie started that first time I saw it. And the older I got, the more I got into movies, I think we return to those because we're curious about why they stood out to us. And then we have more tools for thinking about them and wanting to know what else might be going on there. And each time I revisited it, I just found this also to be an incredibly rich text, to the point that, yeah, I used it to anchor the slashers chapter in the book.
Yeah, I didn't see that one until my wife and I were dating, but I remember in second grade going over to Ian Whipple's house and his older sister had a life-size Freddy Krueger poster taking up the entire outside of her door. So if you walk down the hallway, you look and you see him right there. And it absolutely terrified me.
It's one way to keep you out of her room, right?
Oh, yeah, it worked. So Dave, starting off this episode, I got you with a little jump scare. You were terrified.
Totally.
Knowing that we were going to be talking to you today, Josh, I talked to my son last night. He's 14. his younger sibling is at school camp right now. And so we went out to dinner with my wife, and I've shown my kids a wide variety of movies. I've made that a point. You know, his favorite movie currently is Harold and Maude, which I'm very proud of.
Okay. But
he's really kind of averse to horror stuff. And I asked him what it is about horror that tends to turn him off. And he said that these days he finds that the focus on jump scares is just not really something that compels him. He doesn't like them. Mm. And it seems like that's a big focal point, if not necessarily in the movie itself, the cultural approach to them of this young, you know, Gen Z YouTube film generation seems to be really emphasizing jump scares. So I talked a bit with him about, you know, the old Alfred Hitchcock illustration of the difference between surprise and suspense being, you know, surprise is a couple goes and sits down for dinner and there's a bomb under the table that explodes. And suspense is the audience watches somebody come in, put the bomb under the table, leave, and then the couple sits down to eat and they have no idea. And they're just having a normal conversation and the audience is screaming, get away, get away. And to him, I think he's saying that that is a better way to approach filmmaking, using the visual nature of the medium and all that to clue in the audience to things the characters don't know about. And I'm wondering what you think of that critique and the use of surprise versus suspense.
Yeah, I think that's an important distinction, and they both have their purposes, right? There are some instances where a filmmaker may want to use surprise. And I think of the film Hereditary from a couple of years ago, where something happens midway through that film that no suspense has been laid for. And it's probably the most talked about moment in that movie, probably still in Ari Aster's career. That was his first film. So I think they both have their places. Jump scares are definitely, you know, it's another thing that the genre exploits. They can be easy to go to, easy to execute. I think that's why. But this is a great chance for me to plug the other film spot, the podcast I do, Film Spotting, which is more of a mainstream podcast, because we just did about a month or so ago our top five jump scares. And part of the fun of that exercise was to redeem this trope and really think about what makes an effective jump scare, when they are used, you know, not just cheaply, but in a way that gets the effect, but also in some sense can lay the groundwork for that suspense later, connect deeply with the themes that the movie is interested in exploring. So yeah, I get the suspicion about jump scares for sure. But I think they still have their place in the genre.
Yeah, we were earlier we were talking about Friday the 13th, and I think you had some interesting commentary in your book on this very horrible film franchise, and that's how Friday the 13th can kind of be puritanical in a way. And I think it's, you know, it's interesting to think about it that way, where, you know, the horny teenagers go to make out in the woods, and then that's when the killer comes and gets them. You know, there's kind of a someone is going to trespass, and then here comes the wrath or judgment for doing that. Can you talk about this connection with slasher films, you know, not necessarily just with Friday the 13th, and maybe the not so subtle messaging about sexuality?
Yeah, I mean, this is another trope that's as familiar as jump scares from the genre, right? And to the point that I devoted a whole chapter to this idea of sex and death. And I mostly do talk about slashers in there. I think, you know, along with Friday the 13th, you could put the aforementioned Halloween. I agree with you, Halloween, a much better film, but is also playing in this area, right? Jamie Lee Curtis plays the main character, the heroine, and she is the good girl, right? She's the one whose her friends are trying to figure out how to hook up with their boyfriends on this night, and she just wants to fulfill her babysitting duties. And sure enough, the other friends go first. You see a little of this in A Nightmare on Elm Street. And it struck me in thinking about this as a whole, kind of the posit I pose at the beginning of this chapter is it possible the Bible's more sex positive than this horror genre, just because of the attitude it tends to take? And, you know, we see a lot of evidence in the Bible of celebrating sex as a good gift. You know, we see this in Proverbs. We see this in Song of Songs. Absolutely. And so along with the, you know, prescriptions given around how to hold that gift that we see in Scripture, we see it still as a celebration of a good gift. So I'm interested in the movies that are also taking a slightly different tack than what has been traditionally done when it comes to sex and death. And so one I would recommend for people, if they have not seen it yet, this is a couple of years ago now, but it's called It Follows. Ooh. And it sort of turns this notion on its head, because the premise is that a young woman has sex with her boyfriend and is told afterwards by him that he has passed a curse on to her. This is a curse he had received earlier. And the only way now that she can pass it on is to have sex with someone else. Otherwise, this specter will come after her and kill her. And it's not like a distinct monster. It can take the shape of someone you know. That's part of the fear. That's part of the idea, is that you're not sure where it will be coming from. And I'm watching this movie and realizing, well, this is very distinct from something like Friday the 13th in a lot of ways. But also, man, this is giving sexuality an existential metaphysical weight. And that is something that the Bible recognizes as well. Again, it's a gift. It's not just something to be tossed aside or a purely physical act. And as this movie proceeds, the idea of, you know, sex in your life, how you have engaged with that can follow you. And so to think seriously about what it means and how you hold that. And again, I don't think this is the message that It Follows is necessarily going after. But nevertheless, it's an interesting way to think about it, especially within this larger sex and death subgenre.
It definitely plays on my teenage evangelical anxieties about the prospect of sex. And yeah, that movie, that's 5 stars for me. That's a phenomenal, like, yeah, the production design, excellent. The soundtrack by Disaster Piece, who's gone on to do a variety of other movies. I think at that point, he was mostly known for the soundtrack to a video game called Fez, which I actually own that soundtrack on vinyl. That is, he is phenomenal and really sets the mood of that well. Much has been said, and you write in the book about how, the horror genre, it could be argued more than any other genre, has the particular films are born out of cultural anxieties, and speak to what's happening in the world at the time that they are produced. And sometimes it's more metaphor. If you want to talk about The Fly, I think that's fascinating. What they're getting at and how it's been read. But I'm also wondering, I'm wondering where you see the Trump era anxieties and the pandemic anxieties turning up in films, and if you think one of those areas has produced or will produce better films than the other.
Yeah, I do wonder if those are still coming. Certainly, we're getting movies that that are trying to wrestle with both of those recent experiences. But sometimes it takes a little while longer. It's not the first response movies that can be a little direct. So I'm one's not coming to mind that I think addresses those in a, you know, in a direct way or especially compelling way. I might be overlooking something. The Trump thing, it's funny, you know, a horror movie that we revisited on Film Spotting a couple years ago and found resonant as far as the Trump era was Jaws, and just seeing, you know, and in a way both things combined there, right? It's also somewhat pandemic related in terms of, you know, governmental response to a threat, and what is prioritized, whether it is the health and safety of citizens or other things are prioritized.
And beaches, our whole economy. We can't shut down the economy.
Shutting down the beach. Yep.
So that's, you know, that's an older horror movie, but I think has now suddenly come to reflect that experience in particular. I even joked, you know, it was common hand to kind of refer to Trump as the mayor, right? Who mm-hmm. just wants to keep business going. But then when I rewatched the movie, I realized actually the way he was, you know, even personally handling things during the pandemic. You remember that guy who ignores the warnings about the sharks and goes out swimming? And then when it all goes down, he like knocks a kid off a raft and frantically tries to paddle back to shore. I'm watching it realizing, okay, that guy's Trump. That's Trump because he was dumb enough to go in the water in the first place.
Right.
Another thing that I found, we're just continuing with the theme of on the slasher films here. Another thing that I found interesting while reading your book, and actually I've never thought about this before, is the connection between a slasher film and themes of loneliness and isolation. It is not good for man to be alone, you know, the creator declares in Genesis. Everyone talks about Bowling Alone by Robert Putnam, but it seems like I keep seeing articles pop up about how lonely people are in our modern society, and even talking about the pandemic, you know, we just had people isolated and cut off from society for a couple of years. And with a slasher film, and of course there are exceptions, often a person is alone and then the attack comes from the boogeyman or the monster. So it's a game of waiting until the person is alone, and then they would have a hard time defending themselves against this threat that's coming. Person walks off into the woods alone. Someone goes downstairs by themselves to get a beer, Halloween. Most people think of slasher films as disposable entertainment, but you really talk about something deeper there in the book. Was there a particular slasher film where that light bulb went on in your head as to what that particular subgenre at least could be about?
Definitely. Yeah, this will bring us back to Nightmare on Elm Street, but it's interesting you say that, Dave, about reading, you know, so many reports about loneliness and this loneliness epidemic as it's being described. You know, when I first started writing about this, which was maybe 2 years ago now, that was certainly around, but not to any degree that we're hearing about it now. And so, yeah, I'm glad that I went in this direction just because I think it is tapping into something that is definitely in the air. And, you know, I wanted to write about slashers from a different angle than the sex and death. I didn't want to just reduce them to that, because I think there's more to the genre than that. So I'm revisiting Nightmare on Elm Street, and it's that moment when Glenn, the boyfriend, played by a very young Johnny Depp, is asked by the heroine, the main character, played by Heather Langenkamp. She asks him, I'm going to go asleep, protect me. You know, if you see me struggling because of Freddy coming after me in my dreams, wake me up. And what does Glenn do? He falls asleep too, right? So immediately I'm thinking about the story of Jesus in Gethsemane with the disciples. Yeah. It's a surface comparison. And it's one of those where I was like, yeah, but you can't do that, right? It's like, that's, you know, that's a little flippant. But then I'm rereading those stories and realizing, okay, the disciples fall asleep more than once. So does Glenn. And then I'm thinking more about, well, it comes back to that root fear we talked about when we are asleep. We're vulnerable, right? That's one thing. But we're also, as you were saying, Dave, we're deeply, deeply alone. And so I started seeing some of these connections in other slashers, as you mentioned, not only the fact that characters do almost always die alone, that's when they're vulnerable, whether they're sleeping or not, but think about the landscapes we often see in slasher movies. Loneliness pervades them. If we go back to the original Halloween, this is supposed to be like a thriving suburb, but maybe it was a matter of budget. You never see anyone else on the street. When Jamie Lee Curtis is walking to school, she hardly passes anyone. She hardly sees a car. The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, a crucial part of that film is the lonely Texas landscape that this deranged family lives within. It's as if they've been abandoned as well. And so this idea of loneliness just kept popping up to me. I realized that's what's always struck me about Christ's experience in Gethsemane too, is the utter loneliness. It goes beyond the disciples, right? It goes to the fact that he was asking God to be relieved from what lay ahead of him and gets no response. And that is, you know, speaks to the deep existential, utter spiritual loneliness that I think people who even wouldn't identify as Christians feel. That's the loneliness when you do feel like you're all by yourself in this world, and that there is no one else who may care about you. Now, Christians would look to the comfort that there is a God who knows all things and does care deeply for you as an individual. Here's where the gospel hope comes in. But in these movies, you don't see a lot of that. You see a lot of people who are alone, vulnerable, and often die as a result.
One scene of loneliness in a classic horror film, I think we talked about this with Sarah Welch Larson once, but I love the scene in Bride of Frankenstein where the monster is fleeing. He goes through the woods and ends up in this cabin with an old blind man who plays the violin, and the blind man can't tell that he's a monster. He can tell that he has a hard time forming words and things. So I think he makes some assumptions about his guest, but he's just so happy to have somebody light his doorstep and be company for a while. And both of them are you know, the monster isn't understood and hounded and wants human connection. And this man is not a monster at all, but because he is blind, he is poor, he is seen as not capable of adding anything to society, he's isolated and out in the woods, despite having this gift of being able to play the violin beautifully. And it's a wonderful scene. And I suppose these days I see a lot of talk about younger film viewers that see films as every scene has to advance the plot. And this is one of those scenes that I don't remember all the details of the film, but I feel like it's one of those scenes that you could probably remove and everybody would understand the movie without it.
Sure.
But it's this amazing centerpiece that it's a character portion. It just helps you understand the monster's humanity and everything so much better.
Yeah. Yeah, I love that. First of all, Sarah's great. She's a key contributor for us at Think Christian. But yeah, I like that reading of Frankenstein's monster too as a deeply lonely figure. That absolutely fits.
In the book you write, the comfort of the gospel lies not in denying religious horror and declaring that a spiritual realm doesn't exist, nor does it lie in claiming that the only true spiritual realm contains fluffy clouds and pearly gates. No, as the Apostle Paul clarifies in Ephesians 6:12, our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the powers of this dark world, and against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realms. And yet, in Colossians 2:15, he also testifies alongside, you're talking about the Caribbean zombie movie Ganja and Hess, or it's African-American actors.
Yeah, it's an American film. That's right.
It is,
yeah.
American. Okay. Yep. Quote, having disarmed the powers and authorities, Christ made a public spectacle of them, triumphing over them by the cross. Being an 80s baby, the, you know, satanic panic was in full swing. And I remember, learning about cults in Sunday school and stuff like that. But that verse again about, you know, we're our battle is against the dark worlds and powers and principalities and all that. That verse is a big reason why so many evangelicals terrify me these days. Family members post the verse in posts supporting Trump and January 6th and claiming that we shouldn't do anything to try to stop gun violence, or calling Democrats demonic, which I guess means they think that I'm demonic. What are your thoughts on how Christians use this verse? And what does this verse mean to you on a practical level?
Yeah, your description of your Sunday school class makes me realize maybe I didn't grow up in an evangelical subculture, because I didn't get that. I didn't get that. So,
oh yeah,
I think I remember. You know, there was one instance of a certain album being pointed out as a no-no. But yeah, thankfully I got to avoid most of that. You know, that verse, I think personally I can speak to. I mean, it's, as many verses are, I'm sure it's misused for whatever purposes someone might want to use a verse and kind of not even text proofing. It's worse than that. But for me personally, it's an unsettling reminder that those are the sorts of things I don't really want to think about, right? I haven't had any experience of that, of this sort of spiritual realm, direct experience the way others have. And so the horror genre of religious horror, where I find it reaches me and affects me, is when it puts that in my face and makes me consider that and think about it. And interestingly, because I have grown up as a Christian, I'm a person of faith, it's not the explicitly religious horror films, often Catholic themed, that do that for me. You know, I think part of it for others, I imagine why that's so effective is because they're not as familiar with the verses or the phrases or the iconography. And these things have a certain, you know, not scariness, but unfamiliarity that's unsettling. I know all that stuff. So for me, it's a religious horror movie like Ganja and Hess, which you mentioned, which came out during the Blaxploitation era and mixes Western Christian belief in some ways. One of the characters is a lead pastor at a church, but also brings in this imagined for the film. It's not a real African religion, but this mythology and occult African practice. And the elements of that are unsettling to me. They're unfamiliar. They speak to and are evidence of a spiritual realm. And that's what I have to kind of say to myself. Yeah, I, you know, believe in these things intellectually, but what does it look, sound, and move like on the screen in a way that is not exploitative, because that happens too, but in a way that makes me kind of recognize that there is this veil that I intellectually understand between our tangible world and the spiritual realm. And sometimes movies can not directly pierce through that veil, but metaphorically or through imagery. So that's kind of how I experience it, and definitely how religious horror films work for me.
Not to get on my preaching box here, but I think the war being not against flesh and blood is key there, because it's not against other people, other human beings, right? It's the powers and principalities. And that reminds me of the found footage section of your book, Josh, where you talk about paranormal activity, very much about this demonic spirit, and a very creepy film. I think for Christians to watch that, you get done with it and you're like, you know, per my worldview, that might be plausible or something, right? But it's a spirit that is attacking this family that you talk about in the found footage section of your book. You also talk about the Blair Witch Project, and that movie had one of the most fascinating marketing campaigns, I think, yes, of all time. And it almost made the experience of watching the movie even creepier, because, like, you know, supposedly these people went into the woods and disappeared, or what happened to them, and then you find their footage and go to the theater. And so it was that one of the maybe larger first examples of a movie where it's about more than the movie. It's something that the story of it is almost told, not just with the film itself, but with the marketing and kind of the stuff that happened before the movie even came out and what people were experiencing.
Yeah. So we're talking 1999, and, you know, I don't think that phenomenon could take place now, where, you know, experiences and news, it spreads through social media and other ways so quickly, right? So this is 1999, and this film plays at the Sundance Film Festival. And that was part of that initial marketing, is they were claiming this is real footage. This was, and it's assembled that way. This isn't constructed, it's intricately constructed. That's why I think it's a horror masterpiece, but it doesn't look that way. It looks like it's actually just a bunch of footage people slapped together and threw up on the screen. You know, put it in chronological order for what supposedly happened. And my understanding is at the festival, people believe that, you know, that this was, again, the filmmakers were unknown. The people appearing in the film were unknown. And so it was plausible. Now, by the time I saw it, it was a huge sensation there. And that's why it got picked up by a distributor, got released, you know, around the country. And they tried to kind of hold on to that myth as long as they could. But by the time I saw it, I understood that was not the case, right? I understood it was part of the Sundance marketing plan.
Yeah, same here. I went to see it when
saw
it came out.
Yeah. And you knew at that point? Yeah.
Yeah, I knew, but weren't all the actors like, they had to, I don't know if they had to sign contracts, but basically they had to go like not do any publicity. They didn't have to like go off grid, but they essentially were not, I mean, none of them got more work because of this movie.
And, you know, well, Joshua Leonard actually, you know, I don't know if it was because of the movie, but he's been in a number of things since. Took a while to kind of maybe get some distance from the Blair Witch Project. But yeah, to your point, sure, and that would be easier then too, right? It would be easier for them to sort of disappear when they didn't have social media accounts and that sort of thing. So yeah, it absolutely holds up though. And every time I revisit it, it holds up for me. It's one of those that you have to give it a chance. If you go in snickering, and this was what happened, right? It backfired, because by the time I saw it and you saw it, Zach, it had become a challenge, and people would go in and say, this movie is not going to scare me. Let it try. Let it do its best. Right. We've heard this is the scariest movie of all time. No horror movie is going to work if you go into it like that. So if you're willing to give it the space to frighten you and take it on its own terms, I think that's where you'll see the craft on display of how intricately designed all of these sequences are to unsettle you. Then that carries over everything else. And the movie for me works every time I watch it.
I haven't revisited it. I have not seen it since 1999. And I remember being pretty underwhelmed by it, but I also, as you were saying, like if you let it work on you, like I feel like any supernatural horror for a long time, I went into with just this baseline theological mindset of, well, I don't believe that magical creatures exist. I do believe demons exist. You know, I don't believe that ghosts exist. So like ghost stories are never going to be scary to me because I can't suspend my disbelief if I don't believe in the existence of ghosts altogether. You know, now that I've left behind a lot of that stuff, I can be more willing to go into a horror movie and say, okay, for the next 2 hours, I'm going to pretend that I believe in ghosts or whatever, and let's see what happens. But I think that's in such an overwhelmingly Christian country, I think that's why so many people's go-to example for these of the one that scared them the most ends up being The Exorcist, which I watched at a buddy's house in junior high immediately before going to youth group. I don't think that was a good order to go in. I wouldn't recommend that. You bring it up, and not you don't go into detail about that film, but you do mention the sort of exploitive nature of the filming itself, and how William Friedkin treated Linda Blair. I mean, there's definitely some things that she has to do in that movie that are really shocking and gross. In a, I am uncomfortable knowing that a child had to say those things and do that thing to herself sort of way.
Yeah. It's Exorcist is a tricky one because it's so many people's favorite horror movie. I've had to kind of wrestle with it over the years and have come around to, you know, appreciating it, but still having those reservations. And I think, you know, Friedkin, who just passed recently, actually, you know, I'm not sure about all the behind the scenes involvement, but I'm going by what's on screen. And I have always felt and still do just a little bit of a disconnect between those exploitative elements and how they're handled on screen. And a very interesting religious question that much of the movie is concerned with is this tension between hard science and religious belief, these powers and principalities, right? It's a priest who's the most skeptical in this movie about these powers and principalities until they come out in such full force that he can't deny them. So I think that's an incredibly interesting thread. And it's honestly why a lot of Christians point to this as their favorite horror film, which I get, I understand. It's a matter of sensibilities to me. You know, this is based on a novel by William Peter Blatty. I believe I have that right. And I've not read the novel, but part of me wonders if there is you know, a sensibility towards this religious question that he is coming with that differs from the sensibility Friedkin is coming with as the director. And the tension in the film that I can sense there is what holds it back for me.
Yeah, I'm wondering if you could talk a little, we only have a few minutes left, but I'd love it if you could talk a little about psychological horror, which tends to be the stuff that I'm drawn to the most. I have, in my 30s, I started watching stuff that had more body horror elements and things. It's fun to see some of the stuff like The Thing, just the incredible special effects wizardry pre-CGI that was going on for transformations and things like that.
Like David Cronenberg stuff.
Yeah, but psychological horror like Rosemary's Baby or Get Out or I haven't seen the remake, but the original Stepford Wives. This very psychological attack of, you know, our character knows that something is not wrong, that there is a threat and everybody else is telling them that everything's fine, tends to be sort of the framework of these things. I wonder if you could talk a little just about psychological horror and some of your favorites and what you find in there that's compelling.
Yeah, I think I'm with you. It might be my favorite genre too, because I don't know, it tends to be the most personal. It tends to be the most relatable. Like a lot of times the anxieties being explored in these films are the ones that keep me up at night. You know, they're dealing with, in the case of a great recent one, Relic, an aging relative who has dementia. And that is explored through horror metaphorically in an incredibly powerful way that resonates with me. Similarly, I'll give you another one that I spend a lot of time on in the chapter on psychological horror films, and that is The Babadook. This is an Australian film from writer-director Jennifer Kent about almost 10 years ago now. Wow, 2014. And this is, you know, exploring the anxiety of being a parent of a young child. I've been there. And you know, in this case, a very troubled young child who is suffering from these deep fears. He and the mother have, she's experienced trauma. Actually, we learned this right at the beginning, but on the way to the hospital where she was giving birth to her boy, with her husband driving, they got in a car accident and he was killed. And so this is a trauma that has lingered for her and then down to her son as well. These are very human, relatable things, but then it becomes inflated by this idea of this monster, this Babadook, that the boy believes is haunting them. He reads about him in a picture book that's left in the house, and he believes it's real. And it comes to represent the mother's anxieties and, quite terrifyingly, her recognition of, you know, she might lose it with this kid, and what will happen if her darkest side comes out. And that is intense stuff. Kent, the director, envisions it with some just incredibly, a lot of the production design here is so compelling because their house they share, every surface is either gray or black or a dark blue, mirroring.
They're living in the cabinet of Dr. Caligari.
It really is. And, you know, the depiction of the Babadook itself, you know, it's just one of these unique, it's hard to create a new horror monster these days, right? But they managed to do it. And the way this movie ends, I won't give it away, even though it's almost 10 years old, but speaking to this idea of gospel hope we're circling around and finding comfort in God's love, there's an interaction between Noah, the son, the boy, and the mother, who is played by Essie Davis. Samuel actually is the boy. Noah Wiseman is the actor. But an interaction between them where she might cause him serious harm and how he responds to that. Again, I'm going to leave it at that. But this movie ends in a way that is not patronizing. It isn't like a happy ending. There's an epilogue that's very interesting. But the note of enduring love and how it's expressed just really touches me, I think, in a way that has huge biblical resonance if you want to look at it through that lens.
That was a big blind spot for me for a long time. I finally watched it about 6 months ago, maybe.
Oh, nice. Did you like it?
That's a weird word to say.
Yeah. Did you appreciate it?
I very much did. And I'd seen her next film, which is right up there with Mother for worst noises of the body of an infant doing things it shouldn't do, that I can recall in film. But yeah, I cannot imagine what it would be like to watch The Babadook as a non-parent. I could never experience it that way, since I am one and have been for 14 years now. And it was absolutely terrifying and made me think about all the times that I have lost my temper or made my kids scared of me in a way that made me scared and feel awful about myself. And that was an excruciating endurance trip that I really did appreciate the craft, and she absolutely achieved her vision.
All right. Well, Josh, I know you have to run. Thank you so much for being here. And it was lovely to meet you. For everyone, the book is Fear Not, A Christian Appreciation of Horror Movies. You can also pick up Movies Are Prayers, also by Josh Larson. Listen to Film Spotting if you're not. And Josh, with Think Christian, you're a senior producer over there. Is there anything coming up with Think Christian that you want to let folks know about?
You know, depending on when this episode goes up, but we have something called the TC Movie Club we've been doing for a little over a year now. We get together online quarterly. And if you're interested in the horror topic, our October 23 meeting is going to be all about this stuff. We're calling it Horror, What Is It Good For? So we're welcoming skeptics as well, and just have this general conversation. I'm sure we'll touch on some specific films also. So yeah, that's October 23. If you're hearing this before then, go ahead and you can sign up to join us at thinkchristian.net/movieclub.
And before we let you go, I feel like I need to apologize for getting you in trouble with Adam. I was at the Seattle meetup, the apocryphal,
oh, the notorious.
But I only had one beverage.
Yeah, I was going to say, if I remember from your last show, you're not a beer drinker, so it couldn't have been you who inflated the tab.
I probably had a cider. I was working on trying to get into it. At the time. Yeah, no, I remember. I stayed kind of late. You and I and somebody else were talking about Call Me By Your Name, which neither of us really liked and had some real issues with.
That's right.
And then that night was also the first time I heard about Jordan Peterson. somebody there, like I'd mentioned, like Mars Hill, Mark Driscoll stuff. And they're like, you're disillusioned. You should check out this guy, Jordan Peterson. And I Googled him when I got home and like, nope. But I will not hold that against you or Film Spotting.
Yes, please.
It was a lovely night. I hope there's another Seattle meetup at some point.
Yeah, that'd be great.
So yeah, thanks so much. Oh, and I wanted to show you. I know you're a big Wes head.
Uh-huh.
This is the press kit that I got when I was in on the newspaper staff at Seattle Pacific when the movie came out, and going, I got some glossies and things.
Oh, look at that. You held on to it.
How nerdy is this? I photocopied the cover story from Film Comment that came out with nice. You remember that story?
Yeah.
Was Kent Jones. Yeah. And I tucked it away in there.
That's great. I should have selectively kept some of those old school press kit folders. I had years of them in my in-laws' basement.
It's the only one I kept.
Yeah, well, you got a good one. At some point, I did just end up dumping them. You know, I think they were like, all right, get this stuff out of here. And I had nowhere to put them. So, that took me back seeing that.
Yeah, Bottle Rocket's my favorite film of all time. And into college in 2000... You find your friends by who's seen Rushmore. So, yes, you know,
not a bad litmus test.
I was an early member of the, you know, Yankee Racers forum, all anticipating the release of the Royal Tenenbaums. And
love
for
it.
My senior year, I did the film program available for Christian colleges, doing a semester in LA where.
Oh, yeah, I did that.
Yeah. Los Angeles Films. Yeah. Yes. I was down there recently and ended up driving by the building, not realizing I was about to. I was just following directions to a friend's house, like, oh, that's, you know, they've moved since then. But yeah, I got to see The Life Aquatic at a press screening like a month before it would have ended up playing here in Seattle. And that was like my one goal the whole time. It's like, I gotta see the Life Aquatic. So nice. Me and Brett McCracken was in the class with me and we went together.
Okay. Sure.
And I hated it. I was so mad at the Life Aquatic. I've come around to it since then, but I felt like it was a big turning point. But that's
glad you
that's
came
for
around.
Another day. All right. Thanks so much, Josh.
Hey, thank you,
Josh.
Thank you both. Yeah,
this was
a good conversation. Thanks for your questions. And yeah, maybe we'll do it again down the road.
Dave?
Zach?
Have you gotten over that initial fright? I'm sorry to have scared you.
Shaking in my boots.
I couldn't tell you that I was going to do that. Otherwise, it would have ruined the effect.
Right. Yeah, it's like spoiling the big surprise in a movie before someone can experience it. Exactly.
Yeah. There you go. So I had to respect the form.
Yeah. Well, it was a lot of fun talking to Josh Larson. I actually was involved in one of his movie clubs back. This must have been last year when they were going through the movies of the Coen brothers. And I wanted to be involved in more than just one, but I ended up going to the True Grit one, which is a very, very good movie. And it was great. It's a good crew of people just talking about True Grit and the Coen brothers' work and a bunch of the different themes and stuff going on in the movie. So it was a very, very fun community to partake in.
Yeah, I've been listening to Film Spotting for the last decade, maybe something like that.
Okay. And Jeffrey Overstreet got you into it, right?
Yeah, he's the one that told me about it initially. 2014, because I was at it would have been the following year, I suppose. So 2015, when I was at like a discussion of like the Oscar nominated movies and favorite movies of the year and stuff, and talked to Jeffrey, and he was like, do you listen to Film Spotting? And so I started listening then. So I guess 8 years now.
All right. You're a Film Spotting listener veteran. So you want to say hi, Ruben?
Ruben.
My son is with me.
Hello.
He's speaking of horror movies, there's a monster noise. He is a little under the weather. Stayed home from school today, so we're hanging out. But but yeah, we'll wrap it up here. This has been another episode of Veterans of Culture Wars. Thank you so much for listening to us. Be sure to leave a rating and a review wherever you like to get podcasts. And remember, we have a Patreon, and it is VCW Pod. We are going to be doing a special Patreon only episode about once a month. So if you sign up to be a Patreon, you can have access to that episode. We'll probably do movie reviews, and Zach will share with me some of his memories of growing up in evangelical culture in the 80s and the 90s, and perhaps we'll talk about that and discuss those on our Patreon only episode. So be sure to check those out.
And patrons can also access the Facebook group, which initially we started and made like private and unfindable. So nervous about, you know, Facebook showing my family it or whatever. But it is still private, but it can actually be accessed now. And patrons will get the link to be able to join.
Absolutely. And so if you want to find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at VCW Pod, I am at Dave J. Lester. Zach is at Muzach, M-U-Z-A-C-H. And we are not going to be paying for Twitter. So if Elon Musk is going to go forward with this very much lesser than a half-baked idea to make people pay for Twitter, we're probably not going to be on there. But we are on Blue Sky. And Zach mentioned a Facebook group. We are also on Instagram as well. But the best way to continue to find us is just subscribe to the podcast and it'll show up in your feed. Go to Zach's website, muzach.bandcamp.com. Check out his music, his art, and get a copy of his vinyl record. You can listen to me on my other podcast, Does the Bible Say That? I have about 3 episodes out right now, so you can check that out if you are interested in nerding out on the Bible with me.
Thanks a lot for coming on down to the VCW. And remember, as always, the podcast is free. The Patreon podcast is not, but you regardless still need to tithe 10%.